Welcome to Now Appalachia. The Appalachian region covers 13 states in the U.S., and over 25 million people call the region home. This podcast profiles the authors and publishers with connections to Appalachia and how the region influences and impacts their creative work. And now, here's your host, author and Appalachian resident, Elliot Parker.
And hello, friends. Welcome once again to another episode of Now Appalachia. We are broadcast across the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, all throughout Appalachia and in over 100 countries throughout the world. So we appreciate you joining us here for another episode of the program. I'm your host, Elliot Parker. It's great to have you with us. If you're with us for the first time, we appreciate you coming across our podcast and adding us to some of your podcast listening time. If you've been with us for the 15th time, well, welcome back. We appreciate you joining us once again as we continue to profile the outstanding authors from Appalachia and how the region influences and impacts their works. And we have a returning writer with us on the program today who is out with a brand new thriller that you're absolutely going to love. And his name is John Copenhaver. He was with us a couple of years ago when his thriller story came out, and we had him on the program, and we enjoyed it very much. And he's back again with his brand new book. The title of it is called Hall of Mirrors, and he joins us as a winner of the 2019 Macavity Award for Best First Mystery for Dodging and Burning. And he also won the 2021 Lambda Literary Award for the Best Mystery for The Savage Kind, which is the book we had him on to talk about a couple of years ago. He is co-founder of the Queer Crime Writers, and he's an at-large board member of Mystery Writers of America. And he also co-hosts the House of Mystery radio show, and he's currently a faculty mentor in the University of Nebraska's Low Residency MFA program and teaches at Virginia Commonwealth University. So, John, welcome to the program. Great to have you back after a couple of years hiatus, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you so much, Elliot. It's so fun to be back chatting with you about books.
Yes, I'm so excited to have you back on. When I saw about a year ago that this was coming out, I thought I've got to have John back on because we had such a great discussion with your last book when The Savage Kind came out. And I know it got wide praise and acclaim, as we mentioned a moment ago, won the 2021 Lambda Literary Award. And I know that you have a trilogy planned for these two characters that are featured not only in Hall of Mirrors, but in The Savage Kind, and that is Judy Nightingale and Philippa Watson. So we'll get to them in just a second. But I wanted to ask you, this being book two of your trilogy, what was different or challenging about writing the second book in this series as opposed to the first book, maybe when you were just kind of getting these characters established? Did anything change for you? Was anything more difficult writing the second book with these same characters?
You know, it's a really interesting question. Yes, there were definitely some challenges, and I think new challenges that I had not necessarily experienced before as a writer. I, of course, have planned this to be a trilogy. So before The Savage Kind came out in 2021, I had mapped book two, Hall of Mirrors, and the final book in the trilogy. So I knew what was going to happen, generally speaking. Of course, just because you have an outline doesn't mean that's the way things go. Although, generally speaking, now that I have written and Hall of Mirrors is coming out, I can say that it went more or less to plan. The really challenging part, though, and it's probably something that everyone struggles with who does a series, is how much information do readers who are new to the series, or in this case, might pick up Hall of Mirrors first, need to understand the story. My books are written in such a way that they are pretty tightly woven together. In other words, while there are distinct mysteries in each one of them, there are threads and threads of mysteries that are woven through them all, and particularly characters. So it was like, how much backstory does the reader need? I also don't want to bore a reader like yourself who's read The Savage Kind, and they're like, okay, I know this, I got it. So there's just a balance to achieving that, and that was the That was the biggest challenge I had, and required the most revision, is to get that right. And so, I hope I did.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a terrific book. And I think it's a great book too. If, like you said, if you're picking up Hall of Mirrors for the first time and you haven't read The Savage Kind and you're not really familiar with what happened in that book or with Judy or Philippa, I think you get a good introduction, sort of a refresh of kind of where they are and what they've been up to. So that leads to my next question. This story is set in May 1954, and we'll talk about what happens
Right.
as the book opens in just a second. But between the time of The Savage Kind and the beginning of this book, what have Judy and Philippa been up to? What have they been doing? We know they got themselves into all kinds of trouble in The Savage Kind, and they've walked into a messy situation here in just a minute, which we'll talk more about. But
Right.
what have they been up to since the conclusion of The Savage Kind?
Well, I think the, without giving too much away about The Savage Kind, it does be sort of end with the two girls, going their separate ways. The good news, of course, they find their way back to each other. And a lot of the sort of backstory that I had to blend in for the Hall of Mirrors has to do with sort of their progress, both growing up, because they are high schoolers in the first book, and now we find them as young women, one of whom is a studying in graduate school, and so they have developed, they've had more life experiences. They are different. They're physically different, of course, because they are growing up and their body changes. Their perspectives are a little different. These are not to like Judy and Philip and the Savage Kind, to who are a bit dramatic, and they're still dramatic. But they are, it's tempered a little bit. They're, the way they sort of see some of the characters that they had conflict with in the first book, they see a little differently. I think as you grow up, you start seeing some of the adults in your life with more nuance, and I think that's certainly true for Judy, at least. So I think that I kind of had a, when we have a leap of a few years, the reader needs to know sort of generally where they are and what's happened, and show some of that growth. And I'm very interested in this series in showing their development across these years. So I think there are definitely some books that are in a series which they kind of keep the characters stay relatively, I don't say stagnant, I don't think that's fair, but they're in, very incrementally growing. And that's a bit different here. They're definitely growing by leaps and bounds in different ways.
So we mentioned the story takes place May 1954, and we learn early on that there is a character named Lionel Kane who literally watches his life go up in flames. His apartment burns to the
Right.
ground. The police come to investigate, and they claim that Lionel's writing partner, who is also his lover, Roger Raymond, died by suicide in the fire. And what's really interesting in this relationship that you've created between these two characters, Roger was white, Lionel Kane was black, and Roger was kind of the face of this writing team that they had forged together. And they wrote under the pen name Ray Kane, because Lionel was black and because Roger is white. And one of the themes we learn is that Lionel would not have been accepted really as an author. And that was the reason that they kind of formed this pen name and became a writing team. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because one of the things I loved about your book is you work a lot of historical elements, real life historical elements into the story. And of course, 1954, if any of us remember that, or if you studied that period in history, that was the height of the McCarthyism and the fear of communism and him running rampant in the Senate, United States Senate. But why would Lionel have not been accepted as an author? Had he sort of been the face of the writing team or had been on his own?
Well, I was really interested with this book in showing kind of two things at once. One of those things was the struggle in the characters to be their authentic selves in a world that's so oppressive as the early 1950s were, particularly for people of color, particularly Black people. And certainly if you were, gay or lesbian or trans. And so it would have been very difficult for Lionel to have written as, especially an out, Black gay man, and had a lot of commercial success. I think particularly writing crime fiction would have been challenging, because it kind of, if you know much about the history of crime fiction, has been particularly misogynist, homophobic, and racist. And so, I think, there's always exceptions. Maybe there is a world, maybe there are, and there are examples like James Baldwin, who, do emerge out of that time period and are, writing as their authentic selves. But typically, there would have been a lot of fear of doing that. And I think that so we have Lionel, who, in many ways, is writing behind a mask of whiteness, not because he wants to, but because the situation, forces him to do that, or at least he believes that that's sort of his only option. And so I think that it would have been difficult. I mean, I really also wanted to show the way that just to be a mixed race gay couple in living in DC, which we all think of as this crazy liberal place. I lived there for many years. And there's still a strong underpinning of conservatism in DC, despite, that, people see as very progressive. But I think certainly in the 1950s, no, I mean, this was very difficult for them to have a live-in partnership. Even like how they find a place to live has to be done sort of through Roger, the white part of the team. The books have to be done through Roger's face. They have to present a sort of particularly masculine kind of persona in Ray Kane. And so I just it yes, it would have been very challenging. And so I certainly don't blame Lionel for those choices, but always hope, that, it would be different. It could be different. So.
And we also learn as the story unfolds that Roger was also fired from his job working for the State Department, talking about the culture and the temperature there in Washington in the 1950s. He was fired from the State Department because literally the federal government was going on a witch hunt for gay people, and they were sweeping throughout all areas of government life, including employees. And I wanted to know, did you have to do a lot of research looking back at that period in terms of what was being done and who was being targeted and how all that was unfolding in the 1950s? And if so, were there any sources that were really helpful to kind of fleshing out that part of the story?
Yes, so I did have to do, quite a bit of research, and I think that it's an important time period for us to, I guess engage with, particularly considering some of the things going on now. I think there's a reason why I think I felt compelled to write about it, and I think it's becoming more of a topic of conversation. We had this series on Showtime, Fellow Travelers, which is exactly about that time period, based on Tom Allen's book, which came out a number of years ago. But I think that certainly, like, both reading fiction from the time, reading, about the Lavender Scare, which is this time period that you were just describing, where it was, federally sanctioned that, that government employees, could be fired or not permitted to work in federal agencies, because the fear was, of course, that they would be blackmailed by, nefarious communist, influencers or spies, that kind of thing. Very little of that actually ever happened, and even when it did, it didn't successfully. The gathering of information through those means wasn't terribly successful. So it was more than anything by Joseph McCarthy, political leverage, the use of fear, to motivate people. And that certainly sounds familiar these days. So I think that there's a lot of reasons why I focus on that period. There's a great book called Secret City, which explores, queer people in DC basically throughout the 20th century. I highly recommend it. It covers this period really well. The book called The Lavender Scare. I put a lot of these resources in at the end of my novel as well. So to sort of encourage folks to go and find these resources and read more about this time period. But I hope my book, certainly touches on it and gives it some, I don't know, realism or reality, even if it's a fictional story.
Right. Yeah, that's fantastic. And so we have this storyline on the one hand. We've got the situation with Lionel and Roger and the apartment burning down. And we've talked a lot about your two lead protagonists, Judy Nightingale and Philippa Watson. Well, they're on the other side, kind of involved in sort of a different storyline, and they've become obsessed with this spy and suspected serial killer. They think he's a serial killer. His name is Adrian Bogdan. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. So what why are they interested in him, and what has got them so interested in him? And then we'll talk about how kind of these two storylines come together in just a second. But what gets them so interested in him? Why are they so fascinated by him?
Yeah, so Adrian, it's Bogdan, but it's fine. Like, how would you know? But yeah. But yeah, Adrian Bogdan plays a very, important role in the first mystery. He is in fact, a prime suspect for another murder. Ultimately, you understand that it's a bit of a misdirect, and that he is not guilty of that other murder, but that doesn't mean he's not guilty. And so, and these two girls then, and now young women, know this about him and know that he's never been brought to justice. It's not a lot of, there's not a mystery so much about that. Adrian is a serial killer. They're almost certain he is, but what ha where he went in the years since the Savage Kind, and the fact that there are murders that are being reported in local newspapers that sound a whole lot like his MO, and then particularly curious to these characters is that all these murders are happening and there's no linkage being made by the police, or very little, I should be, sh should say, by the police or by the media. And so why are these atrocious things, the murder of children, and it is true, he's it targets young girls, why is this going unreported and uninvestigated for the most part? And so they want to bring some awareness to this, and they want to catch this guy before he kills more. And Adrian, as you know a bit from the first book, is a pr protected by the federal government because he is an asset. He's a spy. He has information, if that sort of idea of a character who does truly atrocious and horrible things, but is still protected by the halls of power because of what they see as valuable, feels also very contemporary. So I think that, I think that. I wanted that character to, I thought there's more to say about that character, and particularly more to say about the how Judy and Philippa think of him, and what they want to do about him, that really drives part of the narrative.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that leads to my next question, in terms of how both Judy and Philippa kind of approach chasing and pursuing Adrian and their reactions. And I picked a passage on page 246. I'll just read a quick snippet of that and have you comment on how they both are viewing this as the investigation unfolds, or as their investigation unfolds, and what this says about their personalities and how they interact with each other. This is on page 246 when they discover a body, and I won't give too much away. I don't want to spoil whose body this is or what's going on here, but I think this kind of illuminates what you're talking about how they both view him, and it gives us a little bit of insight into their personalities. You write, "What is it?" I asked, afraid of the answer. No response. And this is Judy saying, "What is it?" I asked, afraid of the answer. No response. Philippa, a body. It's a body. I took a step forward but couldn't move another inch. One of the girls? Maybe, she murmured. There's a crust of ice. It's hard to make out the features, but I see a knee and an arm. Something drew her attention. There's writing on her side. I can make out some of the letters, an A and an H. Philippa was trembling, but she wasn't looking away. Take a picture, I said. Use your camera. And I love that passage because when I was trying to think about one that would show that the dichotomy in their personalities, but also both how they're kind of viewing what's happening here, that passage really, really resonated with me. Can you talk about briefly for a few minutes about how they're both approaching this as things really start to get serious and they really start to try to connect what Adrian has been doing and what that says about really about their personalities and how they interact with each other in general?
Well, Judy and Philip are, from the beginning, kind of a case of opposites attract. Philippa is much more, I guess, reserved in the way that she carries herself in the world, and Judy is much more sort of forthright and assertive. But it would be a mistake to assume that Judy's forthrightness actually means that she's less sensitive, or Philippa's reservation and more sort of, I guess, thoughtfulness at times means that she's not savvy and sophisticated, and both of them can be very manipulative, which is in some cases justifiable, and perhaps other cases not. But I think that when they kind of when they're sort of encounter a situation, what you often have is Judy launching in, kind of assertively, kind of sticking her chin out, and Philippa being timid, and then sometimes at moments where that sort of they flip roles, and Philippa is more surprisingly, maybe even surprising to herself, assertive, and Judy at other times shows a real sort of sensitivity and reflectiveness and willingness to take people a little bit less judgmentally than you might suspect at first. So I really like toying around with the idea of the opposites attract, and in some cases, like the what we think of as the, the bad girl and the good girl, and messing it up a bit. I don't think anyone is all bad or all good, and I think, sometimes we wear certain masks or certain, outfits, or even our identity, our sort of outward identities, in a way to suggest something about ourselves that isn't always about who we actually are. It's more about how we want to be read by people.
You're listening to Now Appalachia. Our guest is author John Copenhaver. His brand new book is called Hall of Mirrors, and we'll come back to the book in just a second. But John, I want to ask you a question. We mentioned at the beginning of the recording, beginning of our interview here today, that you do a lot of faculty mentoring, both at the University of Nebraska's Low Residency MFA program. You're teaching at Virginia Commonwealth University. How does that influence or motivate or connect with the writing that you do? Being with students and working with students and mentoring and guiding and sort of serving as someone that can point them in the right direction with the work that they're doing. How does that inspire you, fuel your writing? How does that connect with your writing life as a writer? Or does it?
Well, yes, very deeply. In fact, I don't see myself as teaching just so I could write. Certainly you wouldn't be writing so you could teach, but economically speaking. But I think that I see the two kind of speaking to each other in really interesting ways. I think that working with young people teaches you a lot about human nature. It teaches you a lot about well, certainly if you're going to teach them compassion. I think in more today than ever, we need teachers who are compassionate. I wouldn't say always empathetic. I think that's slightly different than compassion. I think empathy can sometimes get messy if you're overly empathetic as a teacher, but always compassionate and sympathetic. I think that there's a reason why I'm writing about young people. In all my books, I'm writing about young people. So far, now I'm sort of dealing with 20-year-olds. And I think that there's just so much like that goes on when you're growing up, in terms of the way you see the world. I think particularly young people can see the world in the sort of really clear-eyed, absolutely dead on way 1 minute, and then be completely wrong about it the next minute, and confident in both interpretations, or totally miss have total misgivings, and so I just think those kind of extremes are fun to write, and so this is why I write those characters, and find their ways. And you'll also notice, I teach literature. Right now I'm teaching a queer lit class. I'm teaching a crime fiction class next fall, and of course I teach a lot of creative writing classes, and mentor students. And I think that my love of literature is and thinking in the importance of having conversations with literature and about literature are they're definitely in my books. I mean, and no high low rankings. Like I got Macbeth in there, and I've got Pulp Fiction going on in there. And I believe that too. I think it all should be sort of taken, and not and we shouldn't set this sort of this high low idea about some things deserve to be put on a pedestal and other things don't. I think or likewise, sort of reverse snobbery, we're not going to pay attention to the great literature that has been with us, like Shakespeare or something. I think it all sort of has to be taken and seen like as or studied for its cultural impact, I guess. And certainly my characters are impacted. They love to read, and it shapes them in a lot of ways.
Very good, very good. And I do think that Lady Macbeth could hold her own in the Pulp Fiction environment if we transplanted her character into Pulp Fiction. I think she could hold her own.
I totally agree. I absolutely agree. Hence the sort of the silliness of the Ilo, there's just well-written characters and poorly written characters, well-written novels and poorly. There's no, you know, there's no, there's nothing else really. Those are the distinguishing, truths, I think, and all the sort of the genres and a lower status and the, literary fiction, whatever that is in a higher status. I don't buy that, and I think we're slowly seeing a shift away from that. I mean, so many of my students want to write genre. A lot of them speculative fiction, some of them crime thriller, fantasy stuff. So it's where people are engaging too. So.
Very good. If we were to walk into your office or sit by your nightstand, what are some books we might see there that you have read, are reading currently, or maybe getting ready to read?
No, I've been a big fan of Margot Dwight's her debut, Scorched Grace. I keep on recommending it, so that's her new book, Blessed Water, is on my nightstand right now. I have not had a chance to read it, but I'm dying to read it. Robin Geigel, who writes these great legal thrillers. Robin is a trans attorney, and She writes a trans defense attorney in these books, Erin McCabe, and they're just, if you like great, legal thrillers, very sharp, very knowledgeable, but also engaging, not dry. I think, you can do better. I also, because I am being a weirdo right now and writing a ghost story, not at all related, not at all related to either of this novel, trilogy. I am writing a ghost story about my hometown, and so I've been reading a lot of Shirley Jackson, and I've been reading, I kind of going back to a lot of Shirley Jackson, and I think that, I just love the ghost story as a novel. I think I'm equally as drawn to it. I think I have Haunting of Hill House, ready to be revisited.
Excellent, excellent. Our guest is author John Copenhaver. His brand new book is called Hall of Mirrors. It is the second book in a trilogy that he has planned. He's got one book already in that trilogy that came out and won the 2021 Lambda Literary Award. It's called The Savage Kind. Book two in the trilogy is what we're talking about today. It's called Hall of Mirrors. And so, John, I want to just ask one final question about the book. And we talked about a minute ago that we have sort of the Lionel and Roger apartment fire storyline. We've got Judy and Philippa chasing Adrian on the other side. But then everything kind of intersects, and it involves kind of something that carries over from The Savage Kind, and that is Judy and Philippa kind of being deceptive and not really telling the truth to everyone, and they set a trap for Adrian. But without giving too much away, how does that? I love that whole setup because it really brings everybody together around a common purpose, or at least one that Judy and Philippa are interested in. Without giving too much away, how does that bring everybody kind of together, that trap that they're setting for Adrian?
Well, I think ultimately the real intersection point, if you do know the Savage Kind, that these Philippa and Judy are really into this pulp writer. Of course, that pulp writer is Ray Cain, and that Ray Cain ends up, of course, as you mentioned earlier, being these two men, and so they're looking to this writer that they adore. They're not even sure exactly why they adore this writer so much, but they're looking to get this person interested in essentially the story that they know, which is this Adrian, that they think Adrian's out there killing girls again. And if this famous, semi-famous writer, popular writer is interested in this story, then he will end up writing about it and bringing it to light. And so that's the sort of that begins sort of the where the trap begins to be laid. But of course, they don't know initially, they don't know Ray Cain, and they don't even know that Ray Cain is two men or gay men or a mixed race couple. So like they have to discover a lot. This honestly, I'm not this isn't a big twist. A lot of this comes out early in the book. They discover this about Lionel and Roger. So but that sets them kind of on this journey to finding a way to stop essentially this monster. And it means also that they have to interact with their arch villain, Moira Kloss from the first book, who is quite the sort of the older femme fatale. I direct inspiration was Angela Lansbury in The Manchurian Candidate. Like I literally have a picture of I think her last name's Island, but I forget the character's first name, but the that picture of her, because I just wanted that sort of older manipulative mother figure sort of hovering over this whole story. And so she's also kind of playing into this, and they have to deal with her and what she's meant to their story as well.
Excellent, excellent. And our final moments with you today, John. If anyone wants to get in contact with you to find out more information about your brand new book, Hall of Mirrors, or follow you on social media and what you're up to, because you always have things going on, both your writing and your teaching and speaking and doing a lot of different things. If they want to keep up with you, how can they do that? And your book doesn't come out until June 4th, I believe, is the publication date. Let me make sure I have that correct. Yes, June 4th of this year. I know pre-orders are underway, and I know that's really important for an author with a new book. So, how can folks find you, first of all, and follow you and keep up with what you're up to? And then, where can they pre-order copies of Hall of Mirrors?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, the obvious sort of nexus is my website, which is www.johncopenhaver.com. And I have pre-order links there. Yeah, you're right. Pre-ordering really does help. In fact, if you pre-order through Fountain Books, I'll sign and personalize a copy for you. And then you can find me on almost all the social medias, Instagram. I am at John Cope 74, and Twitter, at John Copenhaver, and Facebook on my page and my personal account there as well, and Blue Sky and Threads and even TikTok. It's nuts out there, but I try to have some presence on all those different platforms because folks are in different places. So anyway, yeah, find me, please.
The title of the book is called Hall of Mirrors. Our guest today has been author John Copenhaver. This is the second book in his Nightingale trilogy, following The Savage Kind. This book is terrific. It's a mystery, but you're going to love the historical elements and the add a lot of complexity. There's some great themes in this book about relationships, homosexual relationships, interracial relationships. Violence towards LGBTQ people during the period of an American history of the 1950s. All of that is worked into the story in a brilliant way. It's a terrific book. It will be out on June the 4th, so go ahead and pre-order it now. You certainly will not be disappointed when it shows up in your mailbox, or it shows up on your doorstep, or it shows up on your Kindle or Kobo or whatever you like to read from. It is a terrific book, John. Congratulations on it. And we can't wait to talk to you when you get book three underway, or if you get something written in between there that's not connected to the Nightingale trilogy. We'd love to have you back on the program to talk about it. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Elliot.
We want to take a moment as we finish up on this episode of Now Appalachia to give a special shout out and thanks to our executive producer of the program. Her name is Pam Stack. She's also the executive producer of all the podcasts that you are listening to and following across the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. And we also want to remind you that this is a copyrighted podcast that is owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. And that is going to do it for us this time on Now Appalachia. But please come again next time. And in the meantime, stay well and see you someplace soon, I hope.
You've been listening to Now Appalachia. This is a copyrighted podcast owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. For questions or comments about this program, and to learn more about the host, Elliot Parker, and his books, visit his website at www.elliotparker.com. Stay tuned. More outstanding podcasts are coming your way next from the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.